are back to talk about Thrones. Let's talk about Thrones. And I am here this time with my friend, Sir Anthony of, where are you from these days?
I'm going to claim Braavos this time. Why not?
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So you're from Braavos, and the other guest is, oh, wait. There is nobody else here. We are unfortunately without our friend Jenny. So what Sans are we calling Jenny. Her? The faceless lady?
Yeah, something like that. Although it should still be a faceless man though, right? Because they're all faceless men because it's a misogynistic culture. Anyway.
I really just don't understand that whole thing. The whole thing is so confusing to me, but we will get to that.
Yeah.
So we are talking about episode 605, The Door, and episode 606. I just got that. And as I read it, and episode 606, Blood of My Blood. Let's start. What do you want to start with? Do you want to start with?
Let's start with The Door.
Yeah. Let's start with The Door.
Yeah.
So we are back under the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we're not back under the tree, are we? Yeah, we are. But Bran is in his little Never Never Land, and he's having more visions.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it seems like we had a lot of these. But in this particular vision, he learns something. He learns that the girls that have been helping to protect him actually created the White Walkers to protect themselves from humans.
Yeah, it's an analogy like nuclear weapons. They created the ultimate weapon to defend themselves, which can then be used against them. So, yeah. And it's an interesting scene. Once again, we find that the spirals that I keep telling you about, and now you know kind of this is like the anchor point for all the spirals we've been seeing this whole time, even back to the intro to episode one.
Yeah. It seems like forced symbolism, quite frankly.
Yeah. It's not very fluid. There's more details to be added to it, but yeah, it's, and in the middle is a weirwood tree, and then strapped to the weirwood tree is a dude, and shoved into this dude's heart is Dragonglass, aka Obsidian. And his eyes turn blue, and that's quite a revelation. Bran faces the was it Leaf, I think is her name, in the cave, and says, "You created them." And she starts to explain, "Well, yeah, because we were being hunted by you, by the men." And then, yeah, she's pretty nonchalant about it.
You'd think they'd be a little bit more upset. I don't know. Like, maybe this realization that, maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to figure, though, this is something that she's known for a while. And since Bran got there, she probably knew that he would know that happened eventually. So she's probably been bracing for it, and she wanted to brush it off kind of. I don't know. I get a lot of mixed emotions from her character at this time. It's like, there's like wonder and anger and sadness, like all wrapped in one, but it's not done all that great.
This is one of my least favorite scenes. Yeah, I'm not overly impressed with this. And so, you know, we're going to run through a couple things here because there's some really cool stuff here and there's some stuff here. But in another vision, Bran then sees the White Walkers, and in his vision, they see him.
Right. The Night King actually reaches out and touches somebody.
Touches him.
Yeah. And this vision was done without the Three-Eyed Raven. The Three-Eyed Raven was sleeping, and Bran tried to sneak away and kind of, you know, see a little bit more than what the Three-Eyed Raven was showing him. And now, because of this mark that the Night King has put on Bran's arm, now the Night King knows where he is, and he can get in.
Now, how many stories are there exactly in the history of humankind about someone veering from the advice of their mentor and it going badly? I mean,
all of them.
Do we just never learn this lesson in literature?
Pretty much all of them. It always goes bad. And yeah, so this brings in the next state of events where the Three-Eyed Raven tells Bran, he's on his way now. He'll be here. Yeah. So you need to learn. And Bran says, learn what? And the Three-Eyed Raven says, everything. And now, if you've ever seen the TV show Chuck, now is the Chuck scene where all the knowledge just goes flooding into his head. The Three-Eyed Raven is basically just shoving as much into Bran's brain as possible. And
I was like, where is this parallel? All right.
Yeah. And it's Bran can't take it.
No, it's a little bit more than he expects. But don't they get interrupted?
Well, sort of. Right? Because Bran and the Three-Eyed Raven are in this, they're warging, they're doing their trance, they're doing whatever, they're riding the weirwood net. And the White Walkers come. And it's pretty interesting at one point that the Children of the Forest like fire up, they're throwing their little grenades at them and knocking a few of them off here and there. They don't aim very good.
No, because they really clearly missed the one person.
Yeah, they clearly missed the one person they really want to get. Then they set fire to the entrance, like in a ring of fire, and some of the wraiths or whatever, they go through and they hit the flame and blow up and stuff, and it's really cool. Okay, cool. Well, the Night King comes walking through and just basically waves the flames aside, like, these petty little flames, get this out of here.
Yeah, this doesn't stop me. This is ridiculous. Like, I mean, it was almost as if, then why the theater? Like, what? Well, what's interesting is that the others were still holding back at this point, right?
Yeah.
What I did like about this scene is it was another one of those World War Z-like scenes where the tree is just swarmed with White Walkers.
Yeah, completely. And they're going everywhere. And even once they finally get inside, they're going along the root, the ceilings of the cave. And it's pretty nuts. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that doesn't end well for the Three-Eyed Raven.
Well, it almost seems like it's going to, right? You're given like the slightest little hint that everybody's going to escape and it's all going to be fine. Then you realize the Three-Eyed Raven's he's grown into the tree, remember? So he's not going anywhere.
No.
And as Mira, Jojen, and Leaf are, or Mira, Bran, and Leaf, and Hodor are escaping out the back room, which, I mean, why didn't we just know there was a back room this whole time? they're escaping down this exceptionally long hallway in the caves. To a door, to an actual like physical door, not like a rock slammed in front of a hole, but like a door with door hinges. Anyway.
But made out of tree.
Yeah, it's okay. The magic of the weirwoods. And they're going through and they're trying to escape. The Night King finds the Three-Eyed Raven. And it doesn't end well for the Three-Eyed Raven.
Nope, doesn't end well. And then the wolf attacks.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go well for the wolf.
No, but he does essentially sacrifice himself to give everyone else an extra 10 seconds.
And speaking of sacrificing themselves, let's just follow that theme for a while, because what we have.
So Bran and the Three-Eyed Raven are in a vision of Winterfell back when Ned Stark was a child. Mm-hmm. And Willis is there, aka Hodor. And at one point, at one point, the Three-Eyed Raven looks at Bran and says, they're here, and then disappears into a cloud of smoke, like almost ink and water, as the Night King disperses of him. So now the Three-Eyed Raven just disappears from the vision. Bran is still stuck in the vision. And as Mira and Hodor, Bran, and I believe Leaf was already dispatched at this point. As they're going through the door, they can't get it open. Hodor can't get it open. He finally gets it open and gets everybody through. Mira grabs Bran, starts dragging him along, and tells Hodor to hold the door.
Right. Yelling at him, hold the door, hold the door. And then
we go back to the vision.
In the vision,
Willis starts spazzing out.
And in the vision, you also have the in the vision itself, you also have Bran telling I can't even remember his real human name.
Willis,
hold the door. He's telling him this in the vision, as well as them yelling this at him in real life as they're trying to escape. Mm-hmm. And he basically starts repeating it and kind of ends up getting...
He's kind of in a seizure. Like he can't handle it. And hold the door ends up getting shortened to Hodor.
Hodor.
And
Hodor.
That'd be the only thing he would ever say for the rest of his life. Because as Christian Narn, the guy that plays Hodor, adult Hodor, is holding the door and doing so very well. The wraiths are smashing through the door and grabbing him, grasping at him, tearing him up to pieces. And he successfully holds the door long enough for Mira and Bran to fade off into the snow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get the origin story and the death at the same time. Like,
right.
Parallel with each other. It's a lot. It's really a lot. And I think the first time I watched this episode, I didn't really even get I was still so amazed at how Hodor became Hodor that I didn't stop to think, oh, Hodor is no more Hodor.
No more Hodor. I title. Yeah. This scene really got to me. I think of these two episodes, this is the scene that really sticks with me for so many reasons, because we just learned about Willis. We just learned about his childhood and him being able to speak.
He was a normal big kid.
Yeah. The people basically made fun of, and he wasn't necessarily he wasn't an outcast, but he wasn't kind of, you know, part of the general ring of friends and so forth.
Right.
And so then you see his, you know, we know him now kind of also as an outcast, but basically created by Bran.
Yes. And that's a very interesting issue when you come to the time parallax. Like, how do things in the future affect things in the past at the same time that the future is happening in different, like it gets kind of crazy and
it's a paradox. It's a classic time paradox. There are many stories that try to veer away from that because it's unexplainable.
Yeah. And here they just eat it. They just go full force into it and smash it in your face. And it's done spectacularly. As many problems as I have with this, you know, the cave structure and Leaf's portrayal of emotion, I still think that this scene in total is just amazing. It's really, really done well.
Yeah, absolutely is. And this is, in fact, what they use to end the episode, The Door. Mm-hmm. So that's not the end of their story, though, of course, because in 606, they're continuing to try to escape.
Yes.
And it's not looking good for them.
No. Bran is still stuck in visions. He's still out in the foggy-eyed world. And yep. Mira is just dragging him as hard as she can, and she's losing it. She's losing strength. She's losing willpower. It's cold. Yeah.
They're about to give up, or she seems like she's about to give up anyway. Mm-hmm. And Bran wakes up, and then some random cloaked person on horseback comes and protects them from the walkers.
Yes. That is how it is portrayed at the beginning.
Right.
Yeah. He just rides in and just starts kicking ass and gets them to safety. And no one knows who he is until later.
Until the end of the episode where we learn that the savior was his uncle.
Benjen Stark, the first ranger, the one that went missing that caused John to want to go north of the wall to go find him and all the things. And he relays a story of being caught by the White Walkers. And the children of the forest saved him the same way they created the first White Walker with Dragon Glass in the heart, which puts Benjen Stark in this kind of pseudo, is he alive? Is becoming the Night King a transformative thing that takes time? And right. He's in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Or is he like 2.0? Like they've fixed the process. What's going on? So we just don't know.
Nope.
It was a great callback to season one though. Cause last time we saw Benjen Stark was episode one or two of the first season.
So of course I don't remember him at all.
Right. Right. That's probably how it's going to be in the books too, because he's been gone for so long. However, in the books, they've mentioned him several times in the meantime. So, you know, the smaller conversations that they'll have in the books that they don't have in the TV show, John will mention, you know, my Uncle Benjen and this and that. So it kind of keeps it a little more fresh in your mind.
Yep. But, yep. Thus ends the longest and probably most significant story of these two episodes together.
Well, clearly the most significant because of the visions that Bran was having and the definition of Hodor, but yeah.
Right. But we have a lot of other random stuff going on, and we'll kind of run through that. I want to start with Arya, just to kind of get that out of the way. Mm-hmm. So a girl is still getting beaten by a bully.
That not inaccurate. She's playing the game of faces in Braavos, where basically she has to lie. She has to learn to defend herself using an uncomfortable weapon. She's still getting beat by the Waif, which is this name that Arya gives her in the books, the Waif.
Okay. So she is tasked with killing another person.
Yes. This is another of her trials.
And in an interesting twist, we learn that she's actually tasked with killing the woman who is playing Cersei in a play about her life and her father's fate.
Yes. Yes. It's about the Civil War in Westeros, and her father plays a central role, and Arya she cannot hide her disgust at certain things, and she's genuinely laughing at other points. But when it comes to the betrayal, the portrayal of her father, and Joffrey and Cersei, man, she's not happy with it. So she's supposed to kill this lead actress lady that's playing Cersei, and she gets to know them a little bit by hanging out and learning about her victim. And she basically finds out, though, well, I know who's trying to kill her. It's this younger actress that's jealous of her.
Huh. Isn't that an interesting twist? Also, for some unknown reason, we have a really, frankly, totally unnecessary and gratuitous close-up penis on camera. And I just don't understand what the point of that was.
Yeah. Penis plus plus.
So. Were the pluses the two warts that he had that they were talking about? Come on, really? We're talking about penile warts?
Yeah, I was referring to the to plus plus being the code for increase by one. But yes. Yeah, this is for the same thing, they have just random boobs flying through this episode too. It's like they were like, well, we've been square for too long.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, they're backstage and people are changing, obviously.
Yeah.
But it just seems like so out of nowhere and for just absolutely no good reason.
Yeah.
But in any event, this story continues and she goes back at some point and sees more of the players and actually kind of gets to, like you said, gets to know them a little bit, goes and plants poison in the goblet that the woman playing Cersei would be drinking from, and then at the last minute knocks it away from her.
Yep. And I think this is when she realizes, like, is she fair? Is she just, is this how the world works? She's kind of questioning all those things. And as she knocks the glass away, who's there to witness this but the waif?
Of course. Of course.
So
Arya wisely, I believe, runs and grabs Needle.
Yes.
Not so much just a girl with no name anymore.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, this is why they have trials, right? This is why they have tests. Mm-hmm. And if you can't pass it, well, you have a price to pay. And that's what Jaqen H'ghar tells the waif. Go find Arya either. He tells Arya that either way, after this trial, a face will be added to the wall, meaning either Arya's face or, the actress's face. And well, Arya tries to choose neither, and that's not going to go very well with the House of Black and White.
Well, right. But she chooses that, I believe, because she knows that she is now in trouble. And so she's going to need to be able to defend herself.
Yep.
But we'll have to tune in later on that, because that's the last of what we hear of there.
Yeah. Yep. And, I think it's interesting that the first trial she had was with the insurance salesman on the ships when one of the people on her list walks by. So that's a trial of her new life versus her old life. And she chose her old life. And then in this one, the actress happens to be a woman playing Cersei, which causes Arya to see this play several times, which again, it's her new life or her old life. And she once again chooses her old life.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Making this whole House of Black and White diversion seem more and more annoying, quite frankly, because it's starting to seem more and more irrelevant in the longer story arc, but we'll have to see.
It does pay off. So at least have a hold a little bit of faith.
All right. All right. I will. That's fine. Okay. So let's go to the Ironlands.
Okay.
Because this is short.
It is.
Basically, when we were last there, we saw that Euron had killed
Baelon.
Baelon, I could never remember his name. Yeah. I always just called him Yara and Theon's obnoxious father.
Well, Euron is his younger brother. Right? Yeah, his younger brother.
Right.
He's returned. He throws Baelon off the rope bridge. And here we are.
So now it is time to basically claim the throne. And there is a process by which folks do this. You basically claim the throne. You need people to support you. Then you go through some ceremony. And Yara claims the throne. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks that's ridiculous because she's a woman and that's never been done. And how can we do it? But Theon, who would probably have been first in line, backs her claim.
Yeah. And she starts getting some support.
She does. Until, once again, Euron comes in and asserts himself by interrupting the party, and he claims the throne. Then they put him through the ceremony where they drown him.
He claims the throne. And they go up for a vote, and Yara makes the mistake of saying, "Oh, you killed my father," and he owns it. He's like, "Yeah, I did, because the old man was weak, and we can't have weakness." And that wins over the people of the Iron Islands. Like, she plays right into his hands. You know, they're not there for justice. They're there to be strong. And at the same time, this is the most democratic thing we've seen so far. They're actually voting.
Well, sure. Okay. Yeah, I didn't even have that in my notes because I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So on with the ceremony.
So the ceremony. He drowns. He comes back to life. That apparently justifies his claim to the throne. Everybody's happy, except Yara and Dian, of course. They escape.
Yeah, a small contingent of Iron Island folk escape with them, taking a couple of their fastest ships.
And that's the last we hear of them.
Yes. Now, I do think it's interesting that when Theon came back, they drowned him because he had never been drowned. And he recovered. So, presuming that Euron had already done that once, he now had to do it again to prove that he was capable and chosen to be the rightful king. And I believe when Theon went through it, they kind of helped him out. They're like, they just didn't throw him on the rocks. Whereas Euron, they just threw him on the rocks, said, "Well, if he survives, he's king. If he doesn't, then I guess we chose wrong." It's pretty cutthroat. Like, it's not, there's no goofing around with that.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm trying to figure out the relevance of their story at all, frankly. Theon's the only one that has had any real consequence in the story thus far. Mm-hmm. So I'm, just wondering where this is going to go eventually. Well, but that's it. That's all that we hear of them. So how about if we go up to Castle Black, because not much is really going on there. And then as an offshoot from that, we can talk a little bit about Sam and Gilly.
Yeah.
So at Castle Black, we have Sansa again, kind of like coming into her own, demonstrating some force and confronting Littlefinger.
Yes.
Grilling him about what he knew of Ramsay when he sold her off to him. And all of this is happening in Brienne's witness. And Littlefinger says, "Well, thank God you weren't harmed." And she exclaims, "I am harmed."
Yeah. And this is, I think, this is in a rundown, abandoned building-ish in Molestown, which is this, the little town just south of the wall.
That's right. They're not at Castle Black now. Right. They've left Castle Black.
Because, Peter obviously didn't want to go to Castle Black. Too much hostility there. So he tries to pull Sansa out of it, and he doesn't expect her to bring Brienne. And it's kind of a surprise when she walks in there with Brienne, and Peter's like, puts him back on his heels. And this is Sansa really claiming her own. This is her growing up into her own. Although she's not there yet, she's definitely much further along than she was before. She's willing to challenge the supposed authority of the people that helped her get where she is.
Right. And remember, the last time Brienne was kind of standing up to Littlefinger, Sansa was sitting with Littlefinger.
Right. Yep.
I believe in the inn at the crossroad of the plot.
Yes. The inn at the plot road. Yes.
The plot crossroads. Yes.
He's basically there to offer the Knights of the Vale to help take Winterfell. And Sansa says, "No, leave me alone. Just go away. If I ever see you again, I'm going to have you killed," kind of thing.
Yeah, so they're still on their way, though, kind of moving away from Castle Black. But then John is really going to kind of take off to get an army. Like they need to go find an army.
Yeah, and the idea is if the Umbers and the Karstarks are against them, they're with Ramsay, then if they unite the rest of the houses and seek help from the Riverlands, where the Tullys have retaken River Run, then they will have enough of an army to stand against Ramsay, the Umbers, and the Karstarks.
In theory, yes, sure, maybe. I want to see how this goes. I'm just not confident this is going to go all that well. Also, sadly, John didn't actually cut his hair. He's just pulled it up into some sort of medieval man bun.
Oh, how disappointed you must be.
I am, because I'm like, seriously, man buns were a thing there?
Yeah, yeah, apparently they were.
Oh, man, bad fashion in all times. I just don't understand it. That is pretty much the last we see of them, though. But it probably makes sense after talking about them to jump over to what's been going on with Sam and Gilly.
Yes.
Sam and Gilly are, I call it, in a box on wheels, kind of just like Varys and Tyrion were previously, a little bit less lavish, but they eventually arrive to meet Sam's mom. Mm-hmm. They have this awkward family dinner, and Gilly basically dresses his family down.
Yes, and it's done. So they arrive at Hornhill, and on the way, right before they get there, or Thornhill is Thornhill, I think. Hornhill. No, I was right the first time. See, too many names, Richard. Too many names. Too much names. Right before they arrive, Sam and Gilly have this conversation where Sam is basically saying, "Well, I haven't told them you're a wildling. I just told them that I met you in the north, and this is my son, and blah 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 blah." Well, why can't they know that I'm wildling? Well, because my father hates wildlings, you know, and it kind of gives the premise for this dinner. And then they dress Gilly all up. She looks fabulous, actually, compared to this disheveled look she's had this entire time. And they go to dinner, and she says, yeah, when we were heading down to Castle Black, they're like, wait, down to Castle Black? Where are you from? And that's when things start going wrong. And the mother and sister of Sam storm out, and they're like, this is dumb, and everybody else leaves, and basically he's just sitting there by himself with his father. And yeah, it's just not good. It's not comfortable, and he's basically a big racist.
Oh yeah. Oh, I thought this was an interesting scene, because I frankly thought that she kind of, she stood her ground, mm-hmm. and I liked that. I frankly didn't expect that, because that's not a lot of what we see from her. We see her fearful and uncertain and lacking confidence. There's an interesting moment in here where she mentions something about, oh, well, this is, it's easy to get these words confused. Of course, I didn't know that before I knew how to read. So the other thing that's kind of, I think, an interesting parallel here is that she is becoming more educated, mm-hmm. and that very well could be, and very likely is, not only just changing her view on the world a little bit, but also perhaps giving her some confidence.
Yes. And keep in mind that when the attack started by Sam's father, he was attacking, he started out by degrading Gilly, but then immediately turned over and started degrading and berating Sam. And that's when Gilly really stepped in.
That's when Gilly steps in. Yeah.
And she's like, this is the man that's done all this for me. I'm not going to stand by and let his family do this to him. And it's a great evolution of the character of Gilly and their relationship. You know, and then towards the end, Sam is prepared to leave because he's told he will leave in the morning. If he's ever seen again, he'll be killed. Gilly will be given a job in the kitchens, and little Sam will be educated and treated rightful as a bastard child of Hornhill. Well, Sam goes to leave. Gilly throws out the whole, we were supposed to stay together. And Sam says, I can't. So he walks out, and it lasts about 10 seconds. He walks back in, says, we're leaving. And Gilly, out of all this, she's worried about the dress she's wearing. Like, won't your sister miss it? Like,
right.
Like, no, it looks better on you anyway. And then they go, they take his father's sword, which is Valyrian steel. I'm sure that will come into play at another time. And off they go. He leaves with Gilly and little Sam.
Yeah.
And like, deuces, we're out. Peace. Heading to Old Town. Thanks for the sword and the dress.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. It's the first time I think we've seen anything with any scene with Gilly in it that had any real consequence since at least like a season ago, it seems.
Yeah. And this is an important development for Gilly, I feel, as well, because she's going to come up to some things later on that this confidence, this oomph that she's found will actually help her through. So.
Okay. Yep. All right. So we basically have two other major storylines to run through. We have what might be going on with Meereen and Daenerys, and what might be going on back at
King's Landing.
King's Landing. I almost think like I think I want to end on King's Landing.
Okay.
So why don't we go back to Meereen, where let's go back to Meereen real quickly, because we're only there for a moment. In a very weird and interesting scene, we see Tyrion meeting with some priestess of fire.
Mm-hmm. Her name's Kinvara, and she's the high priestess of the Red Temple of Volantis.
Have we ever seen her before?
We believe we have, but only briefly, and it was like a throwaway, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah, but I did not recognize her at all.
She's like the top red, red priestess. She's the lady.
Yeah. Okay. And I didn't really take a whole lot of out of their somewhat contentious conversation. What I did note here is that for the first time ever, I felt like someone, and it was her, managed to shut down Varys in conversation.
Yes. Yes. Because he started doubting her and doubting her God. And she started talking about the day that he was cut and became a eunuch. And she was like, well, I can tell you the words that he said. Would you like to hear the words? And Varys is like, no.
Yeah. Very, very interesting conversation. And the only other thing that I took out of the scene was that the chandeliers that are in that throne room with the fire in them and the three tiers and everything, I want them. I want some of them in my home. They're really cool. Maybe not with fire, maybe with normal lights. And that's pretty much it for them. So
yeah,
the next portion of this story takes place in, oh, I already forgot the name of that place.
Vis Dothrak.
Very good. Vis Dothrak. All right. And so we have Jorah and Daenerys, and they're trying to figure out their next move.
Don't forget Dario.
What's that?
Don't forget Dario.
And Dario. Yeah, Dario, whatever. And Jorah reveals his grayscale to Daenerys, confesses his love to her, and commits to leaving them behind, and she will not let him go.
Right. This is a scene where she finally starts showing him some actual emotion. He finally confesses that he does love her, that it's not just a mentorship thing, you know? And it really comes down to, I've sent you away and you come back. You betrayed me. I can't keep you. I can't send you away. What am I supposed to do with you? And that's when he shows the grayscale and is like, you have to send me away. I've done what I needed to do, and now right. and now I'm I know how this ends.
Yep. She's like, nope.
She commands him to find the cure wherever it is in the world, to find the cure, get cured, and then return to her.
And I forget, what did she compare that to? Finding her or something? As though you were able to find me or what, you know, whatever it was that he was able to do. And this is somehow equivalent to that.
Yeah. It, I don't remember it, so it must not have been too impactful.
It was just really quite bizarre.
So Jorah goes off and he's off to do his thing.
To apparently find a cure, because that's what he's been commanded to do.
Right. Now, this is the same thing that Shireen had on her face, but mm-hmm. Shireen's not around any longer.
Right.
So where will Jorah go, do you think?
I have absolutely no idea. I have zero idea. Well, maybe not zero idea. I might think that he might go back to where he was infected, where there are lots of these people.
The stone men.
Try and figure out what's going on.
I was hoping you'd have the right answer. Because
is that the right answer?
No.
It's not. Okay.
Well, you don't know that he doesn't go there, but I know where he ends up, and it's exactly where I expected him to go. And I was hoping you were on the same train.
I'm not.
No, clearly.
Sorry. Sorry.
And listeners, if you think you know where he goes, email us at letstalkaboutthrones@gmail.com.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You should do that anyway.
Danny and Dario go to head back to Meereen with the Khalasar of 100,000. And they reach
represented in a scene with approximately 30 extras. This is probably one of the most poorly executed mass
movements,
kind of military movement scenes I've seen in a very long time on this show.
Yeah, it's almost like they had the extras there for the foreground and they were supposed to put in some CGI in the background and forgot.
Yeah, because all of the budget for this episode's special effects clearly went to the dragons, which she calls on and then uses them to kind of get everybody moving.
Yeah. In particular, Drogon, she goes and climbs on his back. Well, she goes to leave and she says she'll be back to stay here and wait for her. And Dario is like, okay. And then after some time has passed, he goes to look for her, and as he goes to look for her, you see the ominous shadow of the dragon on the ground. And yeah, pretty soon it comes and lands and looks at everybody, and she's sitting on his back, just chilling. Hey, how's it going?
I mean, you know, kind of like any general would on the back of their animal when they're about to lead into battle, right?
I can just see an Air Force general arriving in an F-22, opening the canopy and start yelling at his troops. Like, just that's essentially how this felt. And she says calls of the past have chosen three blood riders to ride with them through all the things that they go through. I'm not a call, so I don't have to follow his rules. I choose all of you as my blood riders. And of course, they all get pumped up. Oh, look, the lady that can't get burnt and rides dragons and has silver hair. She wants all of us to hang out with her. Cool. And that's kind of the end of the episode.
Yeah. So one last storyline, and I want to end on this one. This is the storyline back
in King's Landing.
And we have these stupid, annoying religious people, and they have managed to get the upper hand again. So, first off, we have a weird scene with Margaery In my notes, I say, talking some nonsense to Tommen.
Yes. Yes, essentially. She's either playing a new game and hasn't got Tommen in on finding his cursor or his little marker on the board, or she is just completely brainwashed by the sparrow, which we don't know because we haven't seen her except last time she just started talking to the sparrow for the first time.
Right. So that's very, very strange. And I don't even think it's worth talking about anything more there necessarily. But the next thing we know in King's Landing, then Jaime basically has rallied the troops to go and collect Margaery and Loras. Mm-hmm. And they arrive in force, demand Margaery and Loras. But the Head Sparrow is a step ahead of them.
Yes.
And basically brings out King Tommen. So first of all, says, sure, Margaery has atoned for her sins and you may have her back. And then brings out King Tommen, who stands, if I remember correctly, hand in hand with the Head Sparrow, announcing to the people that the crown and the faith stand together.
Yes. And the most beautiful part about this is Tyrell, the old man Tyrell, the head of the house, he looks at Lady Tyrell and is like, "What is happening?" she says, right. "He beat us, you idiot."
Yeah. And that's the other thing that makes this just kind of so poignant, if you will, is that they basically had everyone there. Like they I don't think Cersei's. Yeah, Cersei's there, isn't she?
No, not in that scene.
She's not in that scene.
She's still restricted to the Red Keep.
All right, but they basically, you know, bring everybody there. They're going to get their family back.
Yeah.
And it's not going exactly the way they expect. And then Tommen,
he strips Jaime of the position of in the Kingsguard because, as he says, an attack on the faith is an attack on the crown.
Mm-hmm. And more or less banishes him.
Yeah. Sends him back to Casterly Rock.
Hey, didn't that happen once before?
Yeah, so he's supposed to help Walder Frey recapture River Run, since Walder Frey is in another story we really didn't talk about because it was completely pointless. The Freys still have Catelyn's brother, his wimpy little whiny brother, so they're going to try to regain River Run by trading for that guy or whatever. The Blackfish, which is Catelyn's uncle, he's notorious and for being a great warrior or whatever, and he has retaken River Run. Well, now Jamie's supposed to go to help the Freys retake it. He wants to kill the High Sparrow with Bronn.
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
No, not so much.
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Nope.
So, yeah, ends on a rather sour note. So this isn't the end of that episode. As we mentioned, Dany's speech then followed by her 30 extra army basically going to support her. That is the ending scene. So the episode ends on a higher note, but this is what stuck with me. This is the story that stuck with me in this particular episode.
It's one of those things that anytime Cersei is involved with something, it's kind of, you kind of have to pay attention because you never know what's going to happen. But now she's going to be without Jaime again. And this time she sends him away. She says, no, you have to go and complete your mission.
And here again, you know, why do I care? These are not nice people.
Right. Right. But you still care.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and frankly, that's good storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Any further thoughts on where we go next? Because as I keep saying, this story is just moving, this chugging forward. There's not a lot of filler here.
Yeah, it is. I thought these two episodes were a little bit slow compared to the last four that we have talked about. This right. seemed to just have a lot of story development, perhaps, without an enormous amount of movement.
Yeah.
It seemed very transitional, and I guess that's necessary. But I'll be excited to move on into the rest of this season.
I think it's funny how you say it's transitional and there wasn't a whole lot of movement in the episode when we find out the origin of Hodor's name and how Hodor dies. We find out this entire episode at Horn Hill, this whole time at Horn Hill, all the family drama and everything else for Sam and Gilly, all that happened in these two episodes, you know? Yeah. And all of this was the slow time.
Right. It just compared to the other episodes, this seems slow. The Hodor thing was awesome, right? Like that is the takeaway from these two episodes, right, if you will. But and frankly, I've kind of been bored with the whole Bran storyline.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's because it's been dragging out for so long. And then suddenly we're back with him and it seemed too long already the first time.
Yeah.
And now we're back with him and supposed to care and what's going on there. And
keep in mind, he was gone the entirety of season four.
Right.
Or season five, one of the two.
Five.
Yeah. Completely gone. The actor wasn't even on set, never showed up, never did a casting call for the entire season.
Yeah.
And it still seems too long.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
But it is the slow roll. It is someone trying to absorb the knowledge of all time and all places and all people into just a simple human mind. So it's like, it's not, it can't be a fast thing, but yeah, and I agree. It does seem very slow.
Well, maybe now that he has that knowledge, maybe things will go faster.
It does.
Okay, good. All right. Well, that pretty much wraps up our recount of these two episodes, 605 and 606. Mm-hmm. We will be back with 607 and 608 next. And hopefully we will have Jenny back with us for that episode. It's been a little bit of a crazy time for her. I know that she's been doing a lot of projects and juggling a lot of stuff, mm-hmm, and just, I think, moved her office or something like that. So lots going on, but we look forward to including her in our next discussion, and we want to include you in our next discussion too. And we can do that by you sending us your feedback or thoughts to letstalkaboutthrones@gmail.com.
Yep. 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 And, so I'm Amos, I'm Anthony, I'm Ethan Kane on the Twitter, ETHANCAINE. Richard, you are?
I am Richard Gunther, my actual name on Twitter, and that's RichardGunther.
What?
And that's, I think, all you need to know about me this time. And that's going to do it for this episode of Let's Talk About Thrones.
RITUALMISCOY